At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In Coal Region Hoodoo, author and researcher Maxim Furyk dives into the strangest stories and weird history from his home state of Pennsylvania. From the perils of Centralia to Thunderbirds, UFOs and serial killers, Pennsylvania has no end of high strangeness within its borders. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content and more. Thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise site is available through TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music is performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Maxim acts as our guide as we uncover all kinds of Coal Region Hoodoo. Over the last few years, my guest has added a layer of outstanding work in a series of books focusing on high strangeness and the Fortean. A man moulded by the explosion in weirdness of the 1950s and 60s, Maxim Furyk has a rich background in psychology, addiction, music journalism and the paranormal. A proud Pennsylvanian, the Fortean is better for Maxim's input. Sir, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I'm so glad to be here, and I've heard a lot about you, and I'm honored to be here and chatting about the paranormal and, as you say, high strangeness. So, that'll be fun.
Absolutely. Well, it's always nice, I think, when I have read your books previously, Maxim, I'm always sometimes struck by the way certain authors are able to weave several strands and theories throughout them. And I know when I read your Coal Region Hoodoo book, I thought it was a fantastic piece of work, primarily because often I think Pennsylvania, despite one or two notable cases in certain fields, is one of those states in the US that often gets overlooked by some of its more shoutier neighbors, shall we say.
Well, certainly like our neighbors in maybe down in Louisiana and Mississippi, you know, with the voodoo stuff, or maybe in New England with all the haunted houses and Hexery and H.P. Lovecraft and Stephen King and all that. But with me, I think my reason for writing Coal Region Hoodoo, you know, published by Beyond the Fray, the reason I wrote that was I was frustrated with all of the books that were being written about Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and also Gettysburg. You know, they would write about the white witches of Lancaster and the hex signs, and very, very touristy and very commercialized, or they would talk about the lost souls, the ghosts of Gettysburg, and they would discount northeastern Pennsylvania and western Pennsylvania. And western Pennsylvania, of course, has Chestnut Ridge, and they have the soft coal. Where I come from, northeastern Pennsylvania had the anthracite or the hard coal. And those miners, those immigrants, were hard-working people. They were the next to indentured servants. And they came over here to America, and they heard that the and I heard this from a guy from Poland. He said that the mining companies back in the day would come over and promise these young Polish guys jobs, and the streets of America were paved of gold. So they would come over here and they would work. It's not funny. They would work in the mines. And they never got richer because they were indentured to the coal company. So, you know, there was a lot of just thievery and a lot of bad things going on with that. So I wrote about that in Coal Region Hoodoo and as well as my Shepton book. But what I wanted to say, I wanted to finish my thought, was that Northeastern Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania had wonderful, rich tradition, superstitions that were brought over by the Welsh and the English and the Ukrainians and all of those folks. And it was almost like, you know, we were talking about the British, or I was talking about the British invasion. You know, when you came over here, we couldn't get enough of your take of American art, rhythm and blues. And with this influx of the immigrants into America, a lot of them working in the mines, you know, they brought with them their superstitions. And a lot of that is reflective on some of the things that we believe in, some of the things that have happened. And so that's part of our culture, our wonderful fabric. And I'll tell you what, Pennsylvania is one of the weird states. I mean, you may not know that, but the travel company said that Pennsylvania was number three as far as Bigfoot sightings. And from what I've seen, it's either Pennsylvania or Florida that's number three. But we know that Washington State and Oregon State, no, California and Washington State are the first two states as far as the number of Bigfoot sightings. And then it's either Pennsylvania or Florida after that. But, you know, especially in Chestnut Ridge in a 3-4 county area in Western Pennsylvania, from Pittsburgh to West Virginia, that's where you see all the weirdness. And one of your frequent guests, Stan Gordon, you know, documents this. He's sort of the keeper of the key. You know, he keeps that narrative. It's just amazing what Stan Gordon has done for us.
Yes. I mean, I remember the first time I spoke with Stan, and I was struck by what a prodigious young man he must have been, because obviously setting up his sort of anomalous hotline as a teenager at the birth of the 60s, Maxim, is not the kind of thing you would expect a young man to be interested in, that in this kind of baby boomer period of post-war regeneration, where usually kids would be hanging around the milk bar or the drive-in.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you're right. But Stan did do it to the point where today, if somebody calls the Pennsylvania State Police and wants to report a, you know, dog man or a Thunderbird sighting or an orb, they say, call Stan Gordon. Yes. And Stan will go and they'll call him. They'll give him Stan's number and Stan writes it down. I'll give you an example. A neighbor of mine a couple years ago said that he's this family guy, very religious, stable, has a job. Oh, he's not a crackpot. He's, you know, a rational, common sense guy. He told me that he saw not one, but two Bigfoot. And one was a large cinnamon. The other was black. And I questioned him as to what they did. And he said that they just looked at him like they were curious and turned and then walked away, sort of like Patty in the Patterson-Gimlin film. And he said that they look curious, but they walk like humans, like hominids, you know, bipedal. And I asked him again just to make sure he was telling the same story. And what I did was I called Stan Gordon, and I gave that information to Stan. Stan called my neighbor, took the narrative. And then when Stan documented it, he attributed my name as the, I don't know, witness or whatever part, the sponsor, whatever part I was in that sighting. But just amazing. And, you know, I've talked to a number of people that have seen Bigfoot, and it's all different. I mean, the response is all different, you know, so it's just depends on who happens to see that thing. And I think the people that do see things are fortunate indeed. I think they have some sort of a gift, you know, they're blessed to be able to see things that I don't see. So
Well, it is a fascinating topic, and like you say, I think often It certainly seems easier these days, Maxim, for people to have a more level-headed conversation about a Bigfoot sighting than perhaps sometimes in the past, because you'll still have your certain camps of, you'll have the people who believe, the people who think it's all nonsense, and then you'll have the group that are sort of undecided until it basically jumps up and smacks them in the mouth, really, and says, right, we're here. And yet, I'm always struck by people who come forward who have a long level of experience of being huntsmen or outdoors people, or they work in the forests, or they're rangers, or they're people who have hiked all their lives. These are people who know what a bear standing up looks like. Mm-hmm. And often, especially when it's a hunter or a professional person in that kind of field, when they have a reaction where you can see that they're visibly still shaken by what's occurred, mm-hmm. you've got to give that far more credit than somebody who's ringing in a podcast or a local radio show to tell them about Bigfoot stealing chicken bones out of their bin or something.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You know, and there's different camps. There's people that are true believers. They believe that Bigfoot is flesh and blood, that there's somewhere out there, there's a body and there's DNA. And yeah, we have yet to find that, but that's the Holy Grail. That's what we're looking for. You have people like me that I'm straddling the fence. I'm more of the belief that it's an interdimensional being, that not only Bigfoot, but flying saucers, you know, UFOs, UAPs, shapeshift in between dimensions. And you see them and then you don't. And I think that would explain why, you know, what they called with Bigfoot, the bilocation or the rapid transport, that they're in front of you and then they're behind you. And I've seen in my one book, I made some of the parallels between Bigfoot sightings and flying saucer sightings. And I think there's a lot of commonality there. But with me, I say I straddle the topic because my one foot is firmly in the interdimensional camp. You know, that was, you know, people like Einstein and Jacques Vallée and folks like that. And then the other foot, I think, is in the Bigfoot camp, where you cannot ignore the elements of high strangeness. For example, some of these people, there's eyewitnesses, there's the smells, there's the wood knocks, there's the pebbles that are thrown, there's the wooden structures that evidently are constructed to chase us away or to communicate with us. So there's, and then, most importantly, there are the footcast. Here are the footcast of creatures that are larger than bear or human beings, and they have strides that are larger than anything that we could do or that bears could do. So that's evidence, not good enough for the scientific community, but evidence that should get our attention, and we should all be saying, there's something here. There's something here that resonates, that's getting my attention, and you can't just discount it. Certainly, we don't have a body and we don't have DNA, but we have a lot of other evidence and, you know, not accepted by the scientific community, but accepted by scientists like Jeff Meldrum and people like Lauren Coleman and Nick Redfern and, you know, a lot of other people. So we'll just have to wait and see. But there's plenty of people going out into the woods looking and searching. And that's what we all do. You know, like we're all on this type. I think there's a bit of Indiana Jones in all of us that yes. we're looking. We want to be on that adventure. We want to climb the Himalayas, or we want to climb the Pacific Northwest, or we want to go over there to the UK and check out the haunted castles and all that. You know, so I mean, there's something about us, you know, as we become older, as we become adults, that we retain that childlike sense of wonder, that sense of awe, that belief in things that maybe science can't prove, but, you know, with the belief in the unbelievable. So I think that's my driving force, you know, that whatever you want to call it, that, you know, that little boy sense of wonder that, you know, I hope I retain that throughout my life because it's good. You know, I mean, and I'm enjoying it. So. And that's what gets me exciting about writing my book. So
yes, yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. I think that's the thing. Sometimes these subjects get under your skin, Maxim, whether you realize it or not. Sometimes I know when I've read some of the conversations you've had with people, a lot of them. There's one particular excerpt where a gentleman's talking about him discovering his love of Bigfoot in the 70s because it was on his favorite TV show, The $6 Million Man.
Right.
And he's grown up and had a successful career. And he said, I've left all my childhood things behind, but I can't leave Bigfoot behind. And it just gets into your skin. And like you said about people like Dr. Meldrum, we've had people like John Bindenigel, John Napier, extremely learned men who are absolutely convinced that something strange is out there, whether we've recorded it or not. On top of everything that you mentioned in regards to casts, sightings, recordings of the howls. I mean, I was lucky to speak to the guys from the Olympic Project a couple of years ago, who shared some vocalizations that they'd got. And some of those are just absolutely chilling.
Right.
And you just think, on what kind of level do you start, like you say, to draw that line where essentially the only thing left to get is a body or physical DNA? And obviously, as technology has begun to catch up with us, we've now got eDNA, which has obviously been used fairly recently in Loch Ness, which was quite controversial because it said, oh, well, there's no giant reptile in here. But then everybody was saying, well, there are creatures in the lake, in the loch, that we know exist that haven't turned up on this eDNA sample. So we know they're there, but this eDNA says it's not there. So obviously now they're going to do it again and do a bigger one. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting that there is a dinosaur in Loch Ness. I'm more of some kind of strange mutated eel or something, I think, Maxim, more than anything.
Right.
Having been there, I could imagine a dinosaur living in Loch Ness because it's a very strange place up there when the mood hits it. So I just find it remarkable how some of these subjects, like you say, be it the paranormal or UFOs or Bigfoot or interdimensional transportation or conspiracies, there sometimes doesn't seem to be a recipe for what gets certain people. It just seems to be, as we were joking at the beginning, the paranormal or the Fortean seems to stalk you. And occasionally it could happen when you're 20, it could happen when you're 50. It just smacks you around the back of the head and says, hello, I'm here.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah, I think with, in Pennsylvania, we had the Kecksburg UFO flap in 1965, December 9th, 1965. Something came down outside of Kecksburg. That's Stan Gordon's territory. Mm. And they thought it might have been an American satellite, a Soviet craft, or something from outer space. And then some of the later theories is that the Germans time traveled their Bell to Kecksburg. And so that's the latest thing. But I believe Kecksburg, I think, is more legitimate than Roswell. But yet Kecksburg is starting to have that mythology built like the Nazi Bell. But with Roswell, all we had was something came down in 1947. It was probably pieces of Project Mogul, which was this big balloon type of thing that was looking to see the spying on the Soviets to see if they were conducting underground detonations. And rather than admitting this, rather than the government admitting, yes, we're using the super, thing, they said, no, it was just a weather balloon. So that was a lie. That was a deception. And when you do that, when you deceive the people, when you lie to the people, there's a ripple effect. They start to shy away from science and from authority, and they go from science to pseudoscience. And so they look at all these conspiracies that the government has retrieved UFOs, from Roswell, that they have the humanoids, the extraterrestrials, and maybe there's a trade-off. They're giving us the technology, and we give them a free room and board. Whatever the deal is. But with Roswell, for 1947, so that died 33 years later. William L. Moore and Charles Berlitz wrote the Roswell incident. That was 33 years later. And it wasn't a good book. It wasn't well written. And even Moore distanced himself from that because they didn't like it. But then Moore put together MJ-12, which was contrived. And then Moore was serving as a agent of disinformation and just doing a whole lot of things. So what I'm saying is that Roswell is a myth built on a house of cards, just on a little mound of sand. There's nothing there. Only that we want to believe that there's something there. We want to believe that the government is withholding something from us, and we want to believe, which is, just makes no sense at all, that all of these technological innovations that man made guys like me and you, Paul, you know, that they were given to us by the aliens, alien technology. And that just didn't happen. I mean, man got us to the moon and man gave us cell phones and cameras and computers and the stealth fighters and everything else. I mean, and just like we discount man's accomplishment, look what we do with the Egyptians. We go back there and we can't even figure out how the Egyptians built those pyramids. And so we say, well, you know, because we're too naive, we're too stupid to understand their technology, which was advanced. But we say, well, it had to be the Space Brothers. They came down and they helped create these pyramids and everything. And I am not of that that mindset. I believe that a lot of this ancient alien theory was cribbed from H.P. Lovecraft. And H.P. Lovecraft was the one who talked about all this. And that's, I mean, that's the genesis. I mean, it was a literary guy. So, you know, there's a lot of room for conversation. And I'm not here to burst anybody's bubble and, you know, to be a party pooper. But, you know, I look towards the science and not the non-science. And, you know, when you look at something like Roswell, there is nothing there. It's a sleight of hand. It's trickery. It's a card game. There never was anything there. And all you do is you have people coming forward saying that, well, I saw a body or I was there when they were reverse engineering this craft, you know. And, you know, we have a number of people that have come forward. And the United States government had two in the United States government, you know, because of outcries from the American public that wanted to know, you know, what's the government hiding from us? Well, you know, they were sick and tired of hearing this. Every single constituent was asking. So they started to have a series of meetings to find out what class, and everything's classified. So they wanted to declassify a lot of the stuff. They had a special congressional UFO hearing in July of 2023 with David Grush. David Grush said that he knows where the biologics are, you know, the aliens, and he knows where the crashed vehicles are. And then in November of 2024, they did it again, and they had Luis Elizondo there, who said that, yes, I believe the government is keeping something from us. But in both cases, those 2 years, what did we get from that transparency? What did we get from that alleged disclosure? We got nothing. We got talk. You know, these guys are talking the talk. They're not walking the talk. You know, they're not giving us anything. And I wrote letters to Senator Marco Rubio, now the Secretary of State. Yeah. And Marco was one of the guys on the foreign, intelligence committee. And I wrote letters to him and seven people. Marco was the only one who wrote back to me. And I wanted him to encourage David Grush to show his cards. If you know where these creatures are and where these crafts are, show us, tell us. You know, because Grush said that under the right circumstances, he would share this confidential information. Well, it's been over a year. And nothing. There's nothing there. So, you know, you tell me. I mean, you know, it's a game. It's you know, sleight of hand. It's the government saying we're going to be transparent when they're not. So, what do you how do you feel about that? You're hearing about these congressional UFO hearings over here?
Well, like you say, Maxim. I mean, I've been interested in this subject long enough to have, you know, gone through the mill several times of loving ufology and hating it within a very quick span because of the nonsense.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I kind of left ufology alone because it became, towards the end of the 90s, it was just the same cases over and over again, and we didn't seem to be moving anywhere. And like you say, you'd got disinformation muddying the waters all over the place. It was just a mess. And I think, obviously, from the sort of revelations that came about with the article in the New York Times in 2017 and all the disclosure that seems to have occurred, afterwards, that yes, it seems that if nothing else, there seems to be a more mature conversation going on. But at the end of the day, it's the same old things over and over again. I know where bodies are. We're stealing the technology and backdating it and making out what we can. And the US government's been housing these, and we've got all kinds of things going on. These are things, if you've been interested in ufology long enough, you can go back and it's basically like a piecemeal of everything that's been said in the 80s and 90s. but it's just been repackaged in a more civilized manner,
right.
And it's live on TV. It's live on C-SPAN. We can watch these conversations as they go on, but nobody's giving us any tangible proof. And that's not to say that some of the witnesses that have come forward are incorrect or maybe misinforming people, but I'm very reticent in regards to getting excited about anything that's been said, because nobody said anything that I didn't hear listening to Art Bell 30 years ago when Steve from Texas rang in to tell us about him escaping from Area 51 or something, Maxim.
Yeah. We tend to drift, we tend to gravitate towards the conspiracy theories. We tend to go towards the anti-science, the pseudoscience, just because it's tastier and juicier. It just makes more sense.
Yes.
And a good example of that is Chariots of the Gods, when Eric von Däniken, I think an Austrian innkeeper, wrote that book. I mean, he violated every single tenet of, you know, scientific fact and the way things work. But it was a tasty, interesting document, and people read it, and there were movies and other books and everything else. It was highly successful because people love that kind of stuff. You know, the space creatures coming down and all visiting us. It's like another Bible. It's like another history of the world. I mean, that's what it is. It was something brand new. It opened up the synapses. And so that was, you know, I couldn't figure out how did they, what was it about von Däniken? I mean, he wasn't that good, you know, he's been called out. But for example, he would say things like this, that if the Thunderbird emblem would show up in Polynesia and in Nazi Germany and in the Navajo Nation in the United States, in different times, it must show that the Space Brother came down and visited these people. And von Däniken would use a similar explanation. It doesn't work that way. I mean, people from different lands don't have to go around to different places to have created fire, the alphabet, copper, tools, I mean, whatever. These things happened all over the place. Elements of the atomic bomb development happened spontaneously in other places, you know, some communication devices. I mean, there's stories about that. So von Däniken got a lot of his major tenets wrong, but it didn't matter. People love to read about it. People love to read about it. I mean, they love pseudoscience better than science. And there were so many books that came out to refute Eric von Däniken that really didn't match the numbers, didn't have the financial success, you know, the popularity that his books had. So he tapped into something. And what that was pseudoscience, you know, ancient aliens, all of that. We love that stuff. You know, if you want to make $1 million, that's the book you write, Paul, you know, about ancient aliens, you know, coming down and, you know, and doing that. So that was his success. But I mean, it wasn't that he did wonderful research and was a great writer or all of that. He just tapped into something that we like. So, and there'll be another one. Hal Lindsey's, what was it? A late great Planet Earth, you know, I mean, looking into the four horsemen of the apocalypse and Revelation and all that, you know, that we're going to die, but before we die, we're going to suffer. So that was another, a big one that a lot of Christians were reading. So there's certain themes that seem to trigger people. And I think maybe with people like you and I, we like to discuss the paranormal and maybe to find out what the parameters are. Like, how far does this go? How far out is it? How high is it? You know, how deep? So, you know, and that's, you know, if we could at least answer those questions, I think we've done something for the good of the order.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is. And I mean, as someone that read Chariot of the Gods as a teenager, and I found it fascinating.
Yeah.
It's one of those, but I also really love archaeology and history. And so there was some bits of it, and I thought, well, that's nonsense. I know it's nonsense because I know enough about what he's speaking about here to know that that's just nonsense. Yeah. He clearly doesn't know that much. But like you say, there is this overriding theory that people don't learn things simultaneously, because it's happened throughout history. All across the world, you will have cultures who will seemingly come across an idea at the same time, because it often gets overlooked, I think, because even if you talk about something as simplistic as building a boat, Maxim, people will say, oh, well, it was only the Greeks and the Romans and then maybe the Egyptians who learned how to sail places. And you just think, well, that's nonsense, because how did the Polynesian islands, how did people get across the Pacific? They didn't just swim everywhere. Yeah. So clearly, Asians were really good at building boats. The Chinese were very well known for it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one of the oldest professions is fishing. Are you telling me that people stood by the beach and thinking, oh, I'd love to go a little bit further out, but there's some really big fish? Or did they think, actually, see that piece of that tree that's just floated past us? What if we carved that out and then we might be able to go out there? And that seems to happen all over the world. Like you say, somebody didn't go around and give everybody fire or so, because if he did, everybody would have made the same type of boats. And you can clearly see all over the place that each culture has intrinsically stamped their DNA into their creation, be it their temple, their religion, their clothing, their ceremonies, even to something as mundane as how they built a boat. And they're not the same. And therefore, you have to say that these cultures clearly all came across things in their own time and developed it through their own personal constructs of the world around them, not what was happening 10,000 miles away in Greece.
Yeah. One thing that's always fascinated me was about the Mayan culture, you know, just, a lot of roads and pyramids and civilization and all that. And then they were gone. And what happened? I mean, they're still there, but, they still exist. But as a civilization, as an advanced civilization, you know, we wonder what happened with that, the Mayans, and we really don't know if it was a disease or what.
Well, absolutely. And you only have to look at some of the discoveries that have been made in the last 10 years in Central and Southern America of these lost cities, which I just find incredible. I mean, there was one discovered towards the end of last year, Maxim, which has completely changed the history of South America, because they think that this city is something like 3,000 years old. And everything that they believed up till this point of discovery was that everybody in that area was a hunter-gatherer. Well, now we know that that's nonsense.
Okay.
So straight away, everything we've learned in the last 150 years about South American pre-Christian culture has been completely turned on its head purely by uncovering a lost city in North South America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing. One thing that we talked about, the dinosaurs, what happened to the dinosaurs. And my wife and I had gone, we were snowbirds. We spend summers in Pennsylvania and winters in Florida. So we're in Florida now. Last year, we went back home a different way. We went through Kentucky, and the Ark is there, the Ark Experience. So we decided to go to this Ark, and this was built, from the cubits, from the elbow to the furthest point of the finger, built to scale. Mm. But we went there and checked it out, and here they had, in Noah's Ark, they had cages for dinosaurs. Little baby brontosaurus and little baby T-Rex. And I looked at my wife and she looked at me and I said, no, wait a second. Man didn't walk the earth with the dinosaurs. And how do we know this? Well, we know this because of the KT event, And that was when, you know, I don't know how many millions of years ago, this meteorite or asteroid came down and hit the Yucatan Peninsula and created the Ice Age, where the sun was blacked out. All of the non-avian dinosaurs died. The only thing that lived were the large and small birds. And then the large birds died out because they couldn't find food. And the smaller birds that have evolved from dinosaurs, as I think your listeners know that, right? Birds come from dinosaurs. Well, they evolved and lived on. But anyway, we know that this KT event happened because we were able to trace that place in the Yucatan where it crashed. And then I think it was in the 80s, they found the actual layers of, I think it was iridium, which is a element from outer space. It's not from Earth, but they found these layers of iridium that crashed down there at around the time when those dinosaurs would have become extinct. So science was able to go and come up with data to prove this theory. So man did not walk the Earth with dinosaurs. Dinosaurs died off, and then we came along. And then the other thing with with Homo sapiens, I mean, Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, and Neanderthal walked the Earth together. They say that as much as 30% of us Homo sapiens have up to 4% Neanderthal DNA because we intermingled back then. Yeah. And so that's a reality. But one thing about a couple of things. One, with the Neanderthal, we have a really good fossil record of them because they like to stay in limestone caves. And when they died, they were well preserved. And we know that they conducted funerals and they had ceremonies and they had family structure and all this. And we know this from the fossil record. And then the other thing, too, that I just want to bring up since I think it's interesting is that man shares 98% of our DNA with gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos. So 3%. So you have to wonder, what that 3% that we have that they don't have. But, pretty amazing numbers.
Well, it is. I mean, like you say about Neanderthals, I mean, the train of thought until about 20 years ago was that we wiped them out. We now know that that's nonsense because of the way DNA research has developed in that period, that we now all know that, well, we've got people out there with Neanderthal DNA. There's only one way you get Neanderthal DNA, and it's not through eating people, Maxim, is it?
Yeah. One other thing, too, there was a researcher, I'm trying to think, he's from the UK, but he believed that as Homo sapiens developed powers of cognition, that Neanderthal developed psychic abilities. And so that was his theory, but sort of interesting. And why not? I mean, why not go that route? Because I think that we have that ability to develop psychic abilities. I think that we have innate powers and everything. However, it's difficult, almost impossible to tap into that working your 9-to-5 job, dealing with the wife and kids and the traffic and everything else. I mean, you have to make time for that, to make that your reason, either through prayer and meditation to bring that about. And it sort of reminds me of Stephen Greer, with J. Allen Hynek's Close Encounters of the First, Second, and Third Kind. Well, somebody threw in abductions. I think that's CE4. And then Stephen Greer was talking about CE5, where maybe through meditation and from wanting, we could actually get those extraterrestrials to materialize, so something else, which, shows another dimension, another dimensionality, another possibility. So why not? I mean, take it, table it, look at it, and use the scientific method. Yes, it works, or no, it doesn't. See if it passed the smell test, as we say over here.
Well, there's a lot of things in ufology that don't pass that at all, Maxim, I have to say. Let's be fair. I mean, and it is, like we've just been saying there, even just having a general conversation about certain things, you can, I mean, this is the thing when you look at things like the ancient aliens philosophies and the stories behind them and the works of people like Van Daniken, is that often people say, well, you know, science, archaeology, they don't like the truth. They like to hold on to things. And I think we've just been talking there about two earth-shattering discoveries in the last 20 or 30 years that have completely changed everything we know. And therefore, both things can't be right. You can't say, well, mainstream science is hiding this because they never change. And yet mainstream science is changing because the evidence proves that they were wrong. And they've had to change how it works. And that's how things work. The more we learn, things change. And it will continue to change. And what we know now, in 50 years, might seem like absolute nonsense to certain people. And whilst we talk about this possibility of interdimensional portals and things like that, we already know in science that the idea that there could be parallel dimensions is something that is spoken about in a mature, sensible manner. Whereas 30 years ago, you'd be classed as being an extremely fringe theorist if you came out with that kind of thing. And if you had a PhD, you probably wouldn't be getting much funding after that.
Well, a good example is John Mack from Harvard, who believed that people were being abducted, and he conducted studies and everything. And he was sort of the pariah there. I mean, people were looking down on him because what he was doing wasn't considered to be academic. It was just like fringe science. And, you know, I mean, he took some hits with that. I mean, you know, a lot of the pioneers did. One example, Paul, like what you were talking about with science coming full circle was with there was a British primatologist, John Napier.
Yes.
And in 1967, when the Patterson-Gimlin film came out, you know, a lot of people thought this was the most authentic piece of evidence to support the evidence of the reality of Bigfoot. And Napier had a chance to look at that in 1972. He was at the Smithsonian Institute, and he was there with some other researchers, including some Russian researchers who were very keen on Yeti and Almas and the Abominable Snowman. They believed in it. As a matter of fact, they were the ones who coined the term hominology, you know, the study of these unknown cryptids, you know, we believe exist, but we haven't discovered. But anyway, Napier looked at it and he said, no, this was 1972. This can't be authentic. And because Patty, the image of the female Bigfoot that Patterson and Gimlin shot, had an upper body like an ape and the bottom like a hominid, you know, bipedal hominid. So Napier said it was a fake. They just cobbled together two elements. That was in 1972. In 1974, some researchers in Ethiopia discovered Lucy. Yep. Now, Lucy was man's earliest ancestor. You know how they named Lucy?
I don't know. I've forgotten. I've heard the story, but it's gone out of my head.
Okay. Well, they named it after the Beatles, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Okay. So we're deducting 10 points from you. You should have known that. But so they looked at it, and when John Napier saw those images of Lucy, you know, Australopithecus, he said, wait a second, I'm wrong. Because this was 1974. This was 2 years after he said it was a hoax. He said, no, I'm wrong, because Lucy has the upper body strength of an ape and the bottom like a hominid. So just like Patty, the Patterson-Gimlin film. So John Napier admitted that he made a mistake and believed that this film was authentic. So this was a good example of science giving us data to take a look at and maybe understand some things that before, you know, we looked at it in a different way. So that was kind of an interesting thing. And for me, I think that Patterson-Gimlin film is probably one of the most authentic bits of evidence that we have, you know, purporting the reality of Bigfoot. And I think it's the best thing we have. So,
yes.
You know, thus far.
I know enough about B-movies to know that nobody could have made that in 1967. They could now. And I've always said, Maxim, if you want to prove to me it's a fake, then I want you to recreate it, but you can only use stuff that was available in 1967. Nobody's ever done that. It's like Bob Hieronymus and the suit. Well, where's the suit, Bob? Where is it? You keep telling us you've got the suit, but you never bring it.
Bob could have been a multimillionaire if he would have played his cards right, but I think he was fibbing. So, and I call out the hoaxers. I claim that they've sold their soul to the devil, you know, and they do the paranormal genre wrong. I mean, they sully us, they dishonor us and discredit it. And a lot of people take a look at these hoaxers and, you know, hang their hat on that. And it's just wrong. So, you know, I think whenever we see some of these people, you know, we need to call them out. And over in the UK, the Piltdown Man was one of the best examples of that hoax. You know, it was, you know, I mean, and there was a rivalry between Great Britain and Germany. Germany had their Heidelberg Man, which was the oldest relic. Well, I guess Britain, or some people in Britain, wanted to have theirs. And Charles Dawson, he was an attorney, amateur fossil collector. So he cobbled together an ancient skull of a human. It was old, thousands of years old. And he had the jaw of an orangutan. He filed down the teeth of the orangutan to make them look human-like. And he peppered the area and the bones with, I think it was iron oxide to make it look really old. And so for 40 years, you know, people wanted to believe that Great Britain had their oldest human. And it was a fake. They finally called him out. But it took 40 years and 40 years of deception from scientists and politicians who wanted to have this glory. So, I mean, it wasn't just one hoaxer, but it was like a, you know, like a whole tribe of hoaxers, a whole family, a whole, you know, grouping of that, of like-minded people. So, you know, and that's not the only. We've had plenty. And even with Roswell, here's something that keeps on getting better in the retelling, and the stories get more and more fantastic. And again, there's no, it's like a kernel of truth in a basket of innuendo. You know, there's always a little bit of truth there, but.
Well, I think that's often the hook that gets people tied up in conspiracies and things, because the problem you have is that you will have governments all around the world. It's not, America does not have a free pass on this. It happens in every country around the world, Maxim, I think, that we now know when we look at history that there were things going on that the authorities would say, oh, that's absolute nonsense. But that, you've got to be out of your mind to believe those kinds of things. And yet we now know that, you know, the FBI were drugging people and seeing what happened to them and letting them wander the streets, and inmates were being tested with chemical weapons in prisons to use in Vietnam. And we've had cover-ups here in the UK in revolving government and authorities and departments. It's happened all over the place. And I think, especially if you're caught in one, or you're involved in one, or you have a relative in one, as soon as you realize that one conspiracy theory is true, it's kind of like a set of dominoes. Once one goes down, the next time you see something, whereas before you might have gone, I'm not really sure about that. Now you're like, well, they lied about that, so that could be true. And as soon as that switch happens, you suddenly start going down there. And I know when I was reading the Hoodoo book, it reminded me of one I'd forgotten, which was the TWA 800 accident in the 90s.
Long Island.
Yeah, that was one of the first conspiracies I remember hearing about on cable in that sort of 90s period when American shows started coming over here, Maxim, about all these people claiming that they'd seen a fiery jet fire up from the sea and hit the plane. And all these people were absolutely convinced that this was a massive cover-up. And until I reread it, that's one of those things, it kind of slips out of your mind sometimes, because sometimes you see there's so many that you forget, oh, hang on, which flight is this conspiracy about? But that one was probably the first, somebody's shot this down and everybody's trying to cover it up and everybody's involved and discrediting everybody. And so it's remarkable when I was reading that a lot of people kind of think that is the totem that a lot of people say started, because it was in the infancy of the internet as well. Exactly. People had got message boards and things. Yeah. That this was the one that really sort of started opening people's eyes up to, are they really being honest with us these days?
With my research with that TWA flight, I found out that most of the narrative was anti-government. They believed the government was covering up something from us, that the government was behind this, that it might have been friendly fire from the Navy, that maybe President Clinton was covering this up so he could get reelected. I mean, all of this was just sort of geared towards politics, you know, in anti-government politics. And very much right wing. The books written about it, you know, had that political agenda. So you couldn't separate that crash from the politics with some of these people that were driving the narrative. And so and they were the ones who were putting this together. So, you know, it seemed that a lot of people, maybe thousands of people, saw what looked like to be missiles going up. The FBI claims that it was optical illusions. I mean, call it what you will, but yes, they were saying it didn't happen. And what allegedly what happened was that there were some wires in the belly of the tank that sparked and blew up the fuel tank. Yeah. It was relevant to me because there were a number of kids from Montoursville, Pennsylvania. They were a member of the French Club, and they were going over to Paris. And there was, I don't know, maybe 33 kids with their chaperones. I forget how many, but they all died in that tragic event. And, you know, and that was sort of like it resonated with us back home because it was so close to home. But,
very much so. And I think, I mean, we're talking about this, and it's one of those strange things that sometimes you can have these kind of conversations, Maxim. You know, it's only, what is it, 11 years ago since MH370 vanished. And some of the things that were put forward as explanations for TWA-800 have popped up in this. People are saying somebody shot it down. You saw all these things about people had kidnapped it, had been taken to a secret military base. Aliens had taken it. Russia's got it. China's got it. The Americans have got it. And it's very similar when you start to compare it to that one, particularly. There's a lot of very similar kind of points raised in both of them.
Well, it's because, you know, what triggers us, what gets us excited, what's our interest. And when you take a look at that, you know, we could put together something with all these common denominators, but I think a lot of it's conspiracy theories, anti-science theories, anti-government theories. I mean, they're all, you know, very neatly identified, and you know, there's these categories, but again, the major thing is that the government knows something and they're withholding evidence from us. Back in 2024, we had the drone hysteria of 2024. Yes. And over New Jersey, they were seeing all these drones, and people didn't know what they were, so they were freaking out. But the one representative thought that they might have been extraterrestrials, and she was on one of the government's UFO agencies. So she threw out there that they might have been from outer space. There was a podcaster that claimed that a terrorist stole a nuclear device from Ukraine and brought it to New Jersey, and the authorities were searching for that radiation signature.
Yeah, dirty bomb.
Looking for that. And, you know, there were just so many theories. But the government, you know, the Biden administration wasn't able to successfully articulate what we were looking at. President-elect Trump, you know, said that the government knew something and they were keeping it from the people, which just added to the hysteria.
Yep.
And it was almost like the Chinese weather balloons from 2023.
Yes.
They came, we shot one down. We didn't know what was going on. It was never really explained to us satisfactorily. So, you know, we're left with a little bit of fear and trepidation. You know, we're left with a little bit of unease, only because our government that's supposed to keep us feeling safe and secure, you know, sort of dropped the ball and wasn't very transparent about what we were seeing. And the way that works is, Paul, you know, you look up there and, you know, you keep on looking, you're going to see something. It's that pareidolia. You know, you're going to keep on looking there, you're going to see a flying saucer or something, you know.
Yeah.
Or keep on looking in the woods, you're going to see a Bigfoot or a dog man. I mean, you know, I guarantee. So,
yeah,
it's, you know, so that drone hysteria of 2024 became sort of like a Rorschach test. And we looked up there and we saw things. We saw things that we wanted to see. So,
yeah. Well, it happened here as well over some military bases in the UK. And there was a really odd statement made by a US government official for an organisation I'd never heard of, which was apparently he was a representative of American forces serving in Europe, which was an organisation I'd never heard of until he made this statement. And he said, "We are unsure as to what is going on. However, we do know that these are not hostile." Well, hang on. If you don't know what's happening, how can you tell if it's hostile or not? That sentence makes no sense.
I was speaking with Simon Bowne. Do you know him? B-O-W-N?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Well, Simon has Alien UFO Forecast, and we were talking about the drone hysteria, and he was saying that, yes, that you had the same thing over there in the UK. So so it's not unique, and, you know, it's all, you know, this hysteria is all over the place, you know. So people are seeing the same things, yeah, you know, in different parts of the world.
Yeah. And I mean, it is odd because obviously we're fully aware that drones can be weaponized now. We can see that every day on the news. And so for this flap to have occurred here and in America, I know there were certain sightings in around military installations in mainland Europe as well, Maxim. It goes beyond a couple of practical jokers when it's happening in several countries at once. I refuse to believe that there is a sort of secretive organization of drone pranksters out there who work on the dark web who just like to upset government officials in various countries at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I still haven't wrapped my head around crop circles. I have a couple of theories about that, but also with the animal mutilations. I mean, you know, I mean, those are still out there and have yet to be completely resolved to my satisfaction.
Yeah. So, cattle mutilations is the one that always gets me. I was very fortunate enough to speak to the sadly departed Chris O'Brien a couple of years ago about his work and his incredible book, Stalking the Herd. And that's something I think is one of those aspects of the strange, Maxim, that I think the more you see and the more you hear from people. I mean, once again, we've got ranchers, farmers, people who have worked with these animals all their lives, who are not naive enough or don't have the experience of animals passing, to suddenly go, "Oh, well, that one's very odd. And I don't know what's going on." When someone with 30, 40 years experience as a rancher or a herder comes forward and says, "There's something strange going on here," I don't understand why those people aren't taken seriously. Because when you look at these, I mean, I've seen experiments done where they say, "Oh, well, the eyes, all the soft tissue goes because it's normal infestation and things." Mm-hmm. I've seen experiments done where these things don't happen within 24 hours, 12 hours even in some cases, where cows are fine, bulls are fine, they come the next day, they're gone, bits have gone. It takes about a week for maggots and certain insects to because obviously different insects have different favourite parts of corpses, as with anything. Yeah. And so when people say, "Oh, well, it's just natural selection at work here and this is just how nature is," that's fine when somebody gives you that line. You think, well, yes, of course, bodies do decay and they get eaten and all that. But then when you see the evidence and you see a cow left in a field for a week and it doesn't do what they're telling you, that once again sends people off down a rabbit hole. And they're going, well, what they're telling us, the evidence doesn't support that. But because they're telling us, most people go, "Oh, well, it's just that. They just died and these ranches are stupid."
Yeah. No, when you were talking about the experiments, you know, with the CIA, they had the MK Ultra where they were dosing people with LSD. We thought for decades that Montauk was in Long Island, was where the government had their time travel and mind control experiments and everything. But what I think is, it's not Montauk, but I think there's plenty of places around the world where the government or our shadow government, whether it's CIA, FBI, or some other group that we don't even know about, that's being funded, conducts experiments with time travel, mind control, LSD, whatever it is that can give them an edge, you know, give the military an edge. I was at a conference and the guy sitting next to me was from San Francisco. He worked for the federal government. He worked in remote viewing. And I wanted to go and just have a beer with him and just pick his brain. But he says, "I can't tell you anything." Couldn't tell me anything. So, you know, whether it's who knows? I mean, they probably, they're just dealing with this. Some sensitive probably have the ability to go and see things that we don't, you know. So I believe in all that. And I think that they're using that and the government and, you know, so maybe it's not in Montauk, but it's someplace else. And the thing about the cattle mutilations, you know, we know that the government, they accidentally gassed all these cattle there in Montana, Wyoming, you know, decades ago. And they admitted that. And that was part of the scenario in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
I think one of the theories was that these cattle mutilations might have been the government test, you know, taking out the entrails, the genitalia, surgically removing them to maybe to see what kind of toxins, you know, were in the animal, you know, that they ingested from the soil or whatever. So, you know, with the mutilations, it was either the government was doing that or aliens or cults or predators or did I miss anything? I think those are the big four. You know, I mean, I didn't do it, Paul, so don't blame me.
Okay. Your secret's safe with me.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I mean, it is that for me is one of the most fascinating aspects of strangeness, I think. And I just, when you hear these people being interviewed and you see some of the photos of the animals and things. I mean, there was one on the latest season of Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix last year that dropped. And there is that one particular photo of a cow, which I have to say is probably one of the most uncomfortable pictures of a dead animal I've ever seen in my life. Because it looks like it's sat up, frozen. It hasn't dropped. And it just... Yeah. It defies logic about what a body does when it dies. You don't die sat up and stay there because obviously rigor mortis takes several hours to even start. Never mind. Yeah. It doesn't happen instantly.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't even put up a guess, but I think the Kecksburg UFO is more legitimate than Roswell. Only because the one in Pennsylvania in 65 had eyewitnesses that stepped up immediately, you know, not 33 years later, but immediately, and gave their narrative. We had witnesses that saw the army vehicles cart something out, you know, covered, draped with a canvas. We believe they eventually ended up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where the alleged little grays are from Roswell. And all this, but there's been plenty. And then the other thing with Kecksburg, the Freedom of Information Act, where I think it was Leslie Keen and a number of people used the Freedom of Information Act to try to get information to find out what the government had, what they knew. And a lot of that stuff was either redacted or lost. Mm-hmm. And they claimed that they had information, but that they lost it. So, again, you know, I don't know. But again, we're not getting what we're asking for. And when you don't get that, people believe that there's something amiss. There's a, you know, the first thing you think of is there's a conspiracy. You know, there's a reason they're holding back. It's not that they lost the information, which they could have done.
Yes.
But we don't consider that. We consider the other one, you know, and that's the driving force behind, you know, ufology and the paranormal. You know, people tend to, there's almost like a knee-jerk response. You know, with animals, you have stimulus response. With human beings, you have stimulus cognition response. And I think with some of us, before you get from the stimulus to the response, there's something else. There's something else other than that cognition, you know, whatever that is. It's something is hardwired into us to go someplace else, you know. So that's, I think, the psychological mechanism behind, you know, a lot of the thought process. I mean, why we believe, why we want to believe, why we have a need to believe. And that's the more important thing. So, you know, they, you know, talk about man's search for meaning, like we need to figure things out and put a label on it. We just need to do that. And you know something? You go to bed with a question in your head and you wake up the next morning, you're going to have the answer. I mean, your subconscious will figure it out. So, tonight, Paul, go to bed and ask yourself, did Maxim Furyk really do any cattle mutilations? you'll have the answer tomorrow morning. So.
I'll see where if it comes to me, I'll email you and let you know, Maxim. I mean, when we're talking about murky things and stories, I mean, one of the strangest things about Pennsylvania is Centralia.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because this is another one where there seems to be three versions given to as to what caused this urban disaster, really. I still can't get my head around whatever the reason is. Either, you know, either somebody poured hot ash down a hole and it fell into the coal mine, or somebody went to burn the tip and they didn't realize it wasn't in the same place they used to have the tip and it's on top of a coal mine, or they didn't plug it properly. But the fact that you've got a whole community, there is now, I think there's five people left there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Everybody else has moved. The authorities have taken most of the buildings. They bought them off them. Yeah. And yet you've got this hellfire burning underground through these abandoned coal seams. I had to laugh. One of the chaps who's often put forward about this, one of the excuses was that people were saying, oh, well, it actually started 50 years ago and it just took that long to get there. And then there was a guy who said, well, actually, I had an illegal mine there with my brother. And we know it didn't start then because we were mining there for ages. And if it had been burning that long, we'd have been dead. And I just thought, well, that's brilliant. I'm going to admit breaking the law. But I know for a fact that the government aren't, that's not real. It's happened after this.
Yeah, Centralia is really close to where I live in northeastern Pennsylvania. Mm. And we were going there all the time. But as the story goes, this was back in the 60s, they were, Centralia might have had, it was a mining community, might have had a couple thousand people, you know, a nice community. And Route 61 went through it. And they were getting ready for a party, so they were taking all the trash and throwing it down this mine shaft and burning it. Well, what happened was that torched the anthracite coal, which is, you know, slow burning and very, very, very hot heat. And it's burning to this day. So the road collapsed. It just melted. They had to reroute Route 61. They had a thing called the Turquoise Highway, and all these kids, college kids, would come there and they would spray paint it with penises and everything else.
That's typical how we teenagers have
over here. Yeah,
it's a universal language, Maxim. It's not just you guys.
But every time I went there, I would see a ton of college kids. A lot of them from Philadelphia. It was a mecca. It was one of the third most popular tourist attractions. Even though nobody was making money, they were just going there to see it. But it's burning till today. So with eminent domain, the government bought out all these people and relocated them. And there were conspiracy theories that, well, there's all this rich coal there, so they were just trying to chase the people away so they could mine the coal. But that's not happening. Nobody's mining coal. And the real thing, and I talk about it in Coal Region Hoodoo, and it's one of the main stories there. But there was a priest. He was an Irish Catholic priest. And back home, we had the Molly Maguires. Now, the Molly Maguires were, some people call them terrorists, but what they were, I think that they were individuals that were just trying to make sure that the miners, especially the Irish Catholic miners, had their rights and they weren't being trampled on by the mining companies. And what happened was this priest called out the Molly Maguires, and he was beat up in his buggy. He was on his way to Centralia. He was, and they beat him up, and he went and he, from the pulpit, he cursed the town of Centralia. He said, at the end of the day, everything will be burned down, including Saint Ignatius, the church. And that was his curse on Centralia. And, you know, in the 60s, it burned, and it's burning to this day. So they weren't able to ever put it out. They tried everything, you know, the water, the concrete, the lime, the whatever, you know, and nothing worked. And but just amazing. And there's been horror films written about it, very spooky place, you know, and but when I go there anymore, we would go and park the car and just walk around and, you know, check the place out. There's a cemetery there, and that's about it. There's a Ukrainian church there, and that's about it. And Centralia, yeah, the cursed city. And that's close to Shepton, where my Shepton mythology took place. You know, these miners were rescued after 2 weeks, and they claimed that they saw Pope John the 23rd in the mine, and the Pope had died in June. Shepton took place in August, so it was a matter of life after death. And all three of the miracles that Pope John the 23rd allegedly made happened after he had died. So in the with miracles, the way they're supposed to work is, you know, God works through you. It's not you enacting the miracle, but it's God working through you because you're a pious, devoted, you know, holy person. So that's how that works. And Shepton from 2016, that was my entryway into the paranormal. I mean, I'm a former rock journalist, and I was writing a book about the song Timothy, which was about cannibalism in a mine shaft. And I realized that the song Timothy from 71 paralleled what happened in 1963 in Shepton, Pennsylvania. Three guys entombed, only two came out, allegations of cannibalism. But in Shepton, there were also cases of out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, afterlife experiences. Shepton was the bomb. Shepton was the, you know, just an amazing thing. And Shepton, for me, opened up the doors to the paranormal. That was 9 years ago. And since then, you know, I've sort of like put the rock and roll journalism to the side. And, you know, I mean, I'm just having so much fun with the paranormal. And, you know, it's just, I mean, I found my demographic. I like found my tribe. That's basically what it is. Yeah. And, you know, I've been on countless podcasts and, you know, expos and all that. It's just been a great ride, and I'm really enjoying this. And hopefully I could write a book or two before it's all over, you know, so that's the plan.
Absolutely. I mean, going back to Shepton, though, I mean, the thing about it is, do you think, because it was a monumental achievement to get two men out, never mind everything else that went on and what they claimed to have happened and the allegations that they killed and ate the other man to survive and all this. And, you know, people, all the family of the deceased, believed that that had happened. And I think one of the rescuers said so as well. He was convinced that that had happened. But it wasn't just things like that. You had the fact that Howard Hughes arranged for the technology to be sent there, I believe, and it was the first time that they'd used borehole drilling, which is what helped save the Chilean miners nearly 50 years later, Maxim. So in regards to underground rescue, I think it should be far more famous a case than it is. And do you think it's because of the strange things that were attributed to the survivors that a lot of people have kind of overlooked how important that incident was in real life rather than the metaphysical or the paranormal, that what happened there enabled people to be saved all around the world from that point on?
Well, here's the thing. Shepton rescue technology saved those people in Chile, the 2010 Chilean copper mine disaster. And I had contacted some government officials in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I said, listen, is there any way that we could maybe promote this to the world, that Shepton technology saved lives? And, you know, you need to talk to the right person.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, they think you're a quack. You know, they think you are like some needy, neurotic, mentally imbalanced person, and they don't even give you the time of day. So,
yes.
Evidently, I didn't talk to the right person, but I want to say a couple of things. One, Shepton Technology saved those people in Chile in 2010, and nobody knows about it. Mm. But so it did do that. But the thing about the cannibalism in Shepton, there was a movie called The 33 about the Chilean copper mine disaster, as well as two books written.
Yes.
In all of those books, they said that they only had so much rations. Each one of those guys would get a little bit of milk, a cracker, and some tuna fish. And they knew that at a certain point, the food rations were going to go and kick, and they wouldn't have any food. In the books, they discussed the possibility of cannibalism. If, in fact, we ran out of food, you know, what about if we cannibalize somebody? Would we be able to exist? And the story was this. 32 of the guys were from Chile, but the last guy was from Uruguay, and the word was that if anybody was going to get cannibalized, it would be the guy from Uruguay. So that was the that was in the book, and so that thing about cannibalism, you know, was a reality. Now, I certainly don't believe it. I think that what happened in Shepton, the mine collapsed. It was a mountain of coal and rock between the two miners and the one that allegedly was cannibalized, and I don't believe that happened at all. I think that people are in shock. They're experiencing a state of post-traumatic stress disorder. They're sucking in the coal dust and the dirt and crawling on their hands and knees. And all they want to do is survive. And, you know, so I don't even think they had any appetite. I think they were just like overwhelmed with adrenaline and all those body chemicals that just keep you going. And so it had to be horrific. And the older miner, this Dave Fallon, was really angry because he knew that they were down about 330 feet. He estimated how long it should have taken the rescue team to get them out, and they were taking their time. So he was pissed off. And when he was rescued, he said they should have got me earlier. And for a while there, he was the pariah, you know, but he was a guy that would speak his mind. And, you know, that was one time when Davy Fallon should have just shut up. But the Chicago Daily News had a front page article, and they interviewed him, and they asked him if he ate his mate. And Davy Fallon said this. He said, only evil men would ask such a question. He goes, no, I didn't do that. And he had died before I wrote the book, but I had talked to a business associate of his, and I would ask this guy all kinds of questions, and he answered the questions only as long as he could remain anonymous, because he's a well-known business person. But he would ask Davy Fallon, you know, well, what about the cannibalism? What about seeing your ancestors on these stairways leading to heaven? What about all the things that you saw, the humanoids and everything? And they were true. What they saw, what the miners saw, were true. And the miners were taken around to psychiatrists.
Yeah.
They had lie detector tests. They had affidavits. They went to see Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote Death and Dying. She was one of the foremost thinkers of the 20th century. She said that what they saw was proof of life after death, i.e. Pope John the 23rd. So that's what she said. And also, I don't know if you've had him on your program, but Dr. Grayson, I'm blocking. He's one of the experts on near-death experiences from University of Virginia.
Oh, yes. Yes, I know the gentleman you mean,
And he was also, he interviewed the miners and, you know, thought that there was something profound there. I'm blocking on his name. But anyway, so Shepton was profound. You know, I've spoken with somebody who wanted to do a documentary on the Shepton mythology, and I'm hoping this comes to pass. You know, I mean, you know, it has to align. You know, the wind has to be at your back, and the gods have to be smiling. And so there's a lot of things that have to happen for that to happen. But I'm hoping it does, because I'd love to go and have a documentary and go out to Sundance or go out to wherever and, you know, talk about the Shepton mythology. I mean, that would be great. So we'll see what happens.
Definitely. I think it's certainly a story that needs to be told far and wide, I think, because of the repercussions in history,
yeah,
I think,
sure.
More than anything else, rather than just, you know, it being a localized story about a daring rescue attempt.
And if you want any part of this, Paul, you know, you could be my number one investor. So, you know, that would be great. But I don't know. I don't know how much what this costs. You know, I mean, these kids nowadays with a maybe $2,000 camera or even with their phone camera, they're making motion pictures, you know, so the technology's there. So all you do is need an idea. And I think you could like the Blair Witch Project. You know, that was cinema verite. That was, you know, done on the cheap. Or Night of the Living Dead. That was in Corrigan. Night of the Living Dead on a shoestring budget. But man, what a classic. What a classic horror yarn, you know?
Absolutely. Well, it's happened before and it'll happen again, Maxim. You know, like you, those two you mentioned, Halloween is another one. Evil Dead is another one. Yeah. Where you'd basically got a handful of people who just basically bullied all their friends and relatives to give them money to make a film. And they ended up changing cinema history.
Yeah, and John Carpenter I love, and Roger Corman. Oh, Roger Corman! God, what a love his stuff. I don't care how crappy Roger Corman would have these trailers, and he would use the same trailers for different films, like the car blowing up and everything. So who cares?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, before I let you go, Maxim, what's next for you? I believe you've got another book in the pipeline that should hopefully be with us before the year's out.
Yeah, right. I'm working on Paranormal Apocalypse. Is This How It Ends? And I talk about fear. H.P. Lovecraft said that fear is man's strongest emotion, and fear of the unknown is the most powerful. So I talk about all these forces that use fear to manipulate us, whether it's the government, religious groups, politicians, whatever. And we're being manipulated. We're being kept unsettled, off guard, off balance, and afraid. They like to keep us that way. So my book talks about that. And I think it's a genre that hasn't been, that's untapped. You know, we've talked about UFOs and, you know, demonology and the paranormal and all this, but I think there's very few books about the apocalypse. And, you know, I'm doing this not looking for an audience, but because it's a theme that just is exciting to me and I just wanted to pursue it. And so that's where I'm putting all my research right now. And, you know, so yeah, it'll be done in 2025. And, you know, I'd love to be back on your show, Paul, and talk about it. So,
well, I hope so. And I look forward to it. Maxim, it's been an absolute pleasure. Where can everybody find your previous works and follow you online and get to your website?
Yeah. Okay. So if they want to get my website, maybe get a autographed copy of any of the books, it's www.maximfuric.com. Or, of course, they could shop around on Amazon or wherever else, Hangar One or Beyond the Fray Publishers. Just for kicks, just if you would, you know, look up Coleridge and Hoodoo on Amazon and just see what the reviews have to say. And that's one book that I'm really proud of, you know, published by Beyond the Fray. And it's just almost like an encyclopedia of the paranormal. There's a lot of stuff there. Including my interviews with Ed and Lorraine Warren, the conjurists. So,
yeah, no, there's so many things in that book. I mean, there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about. Gary Heidnik is one. I think probably one of America's most overlooked serial killers, because he's one of those that just seems to. I don't know why people don't talk about him. I mean, he was.
Well, that's unsettling. I mean, you don't want to talk about during dinner, you know. But
No.
Gary Heidnik, he was the last one to be executed in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And he was the person that they used to create Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
So that's
he kept him in a pit, didn't he? Kept his victims in a pit. And that's one of Bill's calling cards.
They shot Buffalo Bill's home in Chestnut Ridge. It was in Fayette County.
Was it?
So they found them. They found a mansion there. Yeah. So that's what Chestnut Ridge is. Just a crazy place. The current issue of Fate magazine has my article on Chestnut Ridge in it. So get a copy of that and check it out. So,
well, if they're going to, if there was a serial killer who was going to live anywhere, Chestnut Ridge seems to be a very apt place for them to put down, because everybody will be too busy looking for Bigfoot, Maxim.
Yeah.
You can sneak under the radar. Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you for the first time. I hope it won't be the last, and I wish you all the best and continued success with your work, and I look forward to your upcoming book as well. Take care, and thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Paul, and thank your listeners for listening. I really appreciate it, and let's keep in touch, okay?
Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts. So I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.